Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Friday Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. It is Thursday, February 21st, 2019. My name is Jeff Tiberi, and for the very first time, we are taping in front of a live studio audience. Your guest today is a 16-term member of the United States House of Representatives, a Democrat whose district includes Chapel Hill and Raleigh, a small sliver of Durham. It's a district that has an odd resemblance to the state of Louisiana. He currently serves on the House Appropriations Committee, the most senior member of our state's congressional delegation. Please welcome David Price. There are three members of the U.S. House that are not currently seated, or three districts. There's the 9th in North Carolina, there's the 3rd in North Carolina, which we're coming right back to, and there's also the 12th in Pennsylvania. It is rare that you have a full body in the House, is it not? I mean, it's pretty common there's a vacancy of some sort for some reason.
It's pretty rare as the Congress starts out not to have a full House.
Sure.
And this fellow in Pennsylvania decided 1 month into his term that he was going to go take a job somewhere, so there
he went. The pharmaceutical industry, yes.
Unfortunately, though, the third case is our friend Walter Jones, who died a couple of weeks ago, and we honored him. We had a group of members, a very interesting bipartisan. Walter was an interesting fellow himself with a rather eclectic political style and a lot of friends that would surprise you, you know, all over the place in the House.
For those of you who are unfamiliar, Walter Jones Jr. was in the state legislature for 5 terms as a Democrat. He ran for Congress to fill the seat that his father, a Democrat, had held for more than 2 decades. He lost. He switched parties in 1994, and then he won 12 terms in the U.S. House as a Republican. He had a lot of friends on both sides of the aisle, was very much a maverick of the House. You first met Walter Jones in 1976 working on Jimmy Carter's campaign.
That's right. I have a photo on my desk to prove it. We were looked pretty young in that photo. But Walter was the son of the congressman, and I hadn't known him, but he was already pretty active in politics down in the eastern part of the state. He was destined for the General Assembly, as you said. So Lisa and I had just returned to the state a few years before, and I had some friends from past political efforts in Tennessee and elsewhere that resulted in my being assigned a couple of congressional districts for Jimmy Carter. So we were part of that campaign team, and we stayed in touch over the years.
The question has come up just in conversational circles in recent months about, would the Congress be a better place if there were 200 or 300 Walter Joneses, or would it just be more chaotic?
The Congress would be a better place with more Walter Joneses. That's not to say you want 435 Walter Joneses. Walter was a man of conscience and of convictions, pretty stubborn convictions. I certainly didn't always agree with those. I did respect the basis for them, though, respected his integrity. He could be very rigid, but he also was very cordial and friendly guy. He had a seat there on the center aisle that he almost always occupied, and we often would just have a word, and that was true of many members at the funeral. It was amazing to me the spread of members who felt that kind of personal tie to him.
There's no more John McCain in the Senate. There's no more Walter Jones in the House. Is there a senator or a representative who embodies what they have brought in terms of bipartisanship to Congress? Who's there now?
There are members who have a capacity for that kind of bipartisan work. none quite like Walter. He was a unique character, but I also think the despite what you see on C-SPAN and the accurate impression that Congress is more polarized and more partisan, it is, and that's a reflection of what's going on in the country. It's not just something members of Congress do. There are places like the Appropriations Committee, for example, where it's one reason I like serving there. There are places where bipartisan accommodation is still practiced and where the Congress depends on that. You know, we are not going in our system to have a budget. We're not going to keep the lights on in government unless we have some capacity to agree and to compromise. And so and we have a system of government where the Congress is the first branch of government, the Article I branch of government, and where no matter who the president is or what the party lineup is, there is an institutional role that that we historically have played and should play. And so that institutional role is most convincing and most effective when it isn't purely partisan, when you have Democrats and Republicans working together on the appropriations committees to scrutinize the executive budget, to grill the executive officials, to write appropriations bills that don't by any means just faithfully reflect what the president has asked for, but on the contrary, set priorities based on our deliberations and our best judgment.
Congressman David Price is here on the WNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Rep. David E. Price. Talking about some of this bipartisanship, there, of course, was the longest in American history, government shutdown last year into this year. And then the Congress came together in a bipartisan manner to pass a border security bill, pass a funding measure that has for now kept the government open. And I think most people agree that that is in their own best interests, Republicans and Democrats. You were one of the conferees who was negotiating a deal, negotiating some sort of compromise. If you would just set the scene for us, what does that look like? Are you phoning in? Are you all in the same room? The door's locked? Are there hordes of Chinese food deliveries coming in? I mean, what's it like for a conferee?
Well, one thing that was noteworthy about this, I suppose, that it actually was a genuine conference. And we often found ourselves having to explain, what is a conference? You know, this is the mechanism by which the House and Senate work out the differences between bills that they have passed and then bring a common version back for final approval. This is a standard congressional procedure that unfortunately has pretty much gone out of fashion. It's been a long time since I've been in a genuine conference. We have had them on appropriations, and I hope we'll have them again. So it's a process that has often given way to kind of leadership-driven discussions that at the end of the session, where there's lots of drama and lots of shutdowns and near shutdowns and that sort of thing. That's unfortunately become very common. So using a genuine conference committee to work out this was unusual. And I wouldn't say that it was a model conference. We did have discussions. We had, three public meetings. Mm-hmm. Well, two public meetings and one meeting that involved taking some testimony from the Homeland Security Department. Otherwise, there were meetings among ourselves. The Democratic conferees on the House side met several times, and there was some when we were home one weekend, there was a lot of calling back and forth. So we were conferring among ourselves, and I think our representatives, which would be Nita Lowy, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Lucille Roy Ballard, the Homeland Security chairman, they weren't just freelancing. They were conferring with the rest of us, and we had a common position going forward. Leadership, the new leadership, Nancy Pelosi, our speaker, and her team had a strong interest in this. She doesn't leave too much to chance. She's a strong leader, and you know, the House has evolved to the point where the leadership is more centralized. And especially at something like this, at the end of the session where it involves such a wide range of bills and subject matters. I mean, we were doing a conference on 7 bills. It wasn't just about the border question. It was about 7 bills, and so it did have a pretty wide spread. So she was in close contact, but I felt like we had a good team effort, and the conferees were carefully chosen. There was a leading member of the Black Caucus, Barbara Lee, a very progressive member. There were a couple of leading Hispanic members, and so on. It was a conference that was chosen as among senior appropriators, but also touching certain political bases in the House. You say this was a bipartisan exercise. It was, but you certainly wouldn't want to hold this whole scenario up as any kind of bipartisan example. You know, we had a tough time. We typically now have a tough time passing our appropriations bills on budget and on time. We've been laboring now for way too long under this awful, awful Budget Control Act, which the Tea Party Congress forced on President Obama, in order to get the debt ceiling raised. You may remember that unhappy episode, 2011. So we end up with this Budget Control Act. That gave us the term sequestration. And those unrealistic low levels of appropriations are now baked into our annual budget resolutions. And so for years now, we've had to go through near-death experiences at the end of the budget cycle. With budgets that simply don't make sense, and get a budget agreement at the last minute, and then we write our appropriations bills, and then the bipartisan cooperation kicks in. Okay, so we were in the second year of a 2-year budget agreement, so we had a pretty good year on appropriations. We could write bills. We passed 5 of them, but then we ran out of time. And I was the ranking member. I'm now the chairman of the Transportation and Housing Subcommittee. That was one of the bills caught in this. If we'd had one more week in September, we could have passed that bill. There was a cluster of 4 bills that could have gone through, and that would have been very, very good to set that example of good budgeting. Anyway, we didn't make it. And so we then went into the we passed continuing resolutions with those 7 bills. That got us into the fall. And then you know the rest of the story. The Senate had signals from President Trump that he would sign the bills at a certain level of funding, and he switched signals, and so the Senate was left in the lurch. And the Republicans, as well as Democrats, didn't like that. They weren't always necessarily public about it, but it's relevant to the outcome in this sense. I think that when we did sit down in the conference, these Republicans were not—they weren't going to fall on their sword about a border fence. They really weren't. I mean, the border fence or a border wall is an issue that came out of the Trump campaign. You know, we built years ago, and this was partly under Democratic leadership. We built some barriers down on the southwest border. And we did it very carefully. We assessed what was the best way to achieve security and whether this made sense in cost-benefit terms. I was chairman of the Homeland Security Committee during part of that process. So, and then for years, the Republicans had hardly talked about a barrier. You know, this wasn't something that was a simmering issue that Trump picked up and ran with. No, it was something he picked out of thin air, just as a symbol of his immigration approach. And so the Republicans were not wedded to this. Moreover, they were pretty unimpressed with the way he handled this, because he didn't ask for this fence at the beginning of the appropriations cycle. He sprung it on us in December. All of a sudden he says, I'm not going to sign this. I'm not going to sign these other 7 bills until I get my wall. So the Republicans were I think in a mood to reach some kind of accommodation, and that helped. We held ourselves out as the cool heads in the room who could work this out if you just gave us a little time and space, and that's pretty much the way it worked out.
Where does this issue go from here, from the appropriations standpoint? I mean, you all pull the levers of immigration enforcement. Appropriations could be reduced there. They could maintain, they could, I guess, grow moving into the future. From an appropriation standpoint, what are your pressure points and how do you anticipate pushing them, influencing those?
Well, we do have a new majority, a Democratic majority that is going to write a rather different set of appropriations bills than what we got, although we will not go through this this drama of passing bills at sequestration levels and then having a crisis at the end. We will write our bills this spring and this summer. We will write our bills to more sensible top-line numbers. The Senate, I believe, will do the same thing. And so I'm hoping for an appropriations season that looks looks more normal.
Divided government, you're more confident it will move more quickly?
Yes, I say that cautiously, and of course I know who the president is and what might happen at the end of the process. But you have in the Senate, because of the way Senate rules operate, you have a incentives to a more bipartisan operation there too, and now you have new leadership in the House. I think we will have better top-line numbers going into this. I think we will have better bills, more cooperatively written. But there, of course, are lots of snags along the way. The other thing, though, I have to say is the larger issue of immigration policy is just a raw sore in this country, in our politics and in our communities, and that, of course, is what this wall became a symbol of. You know, it wasn't just a nuts and bolts discussion about what kind of physical structures you might need here or there. This became a very fraught issue because of the immigration policy that Trump has foisted on the country. The separation of children at the border, the closing of the door to refugees, the denial of temporary protected status from these desperate countries, betrayal, that is not too strong a word, the betrayal of these dreamers. These random deportations, and now this has reached a new level in this area, poking our sheriffs in the eye and saying you need to be the long arm of ICE. You know, that is unacceptable. It is immoral, and so it shouldn't surprise anyone that immigration debate affects, you know, how these funding decisions get made. So we've got a huge challenge in the Congress to confront this and deal with it.
There's immigration, there's health care, there's the economy. Are those the three biggest issues as we head toward 2020?
I think those are the three broad areas, and the kind of agenda we've set here in these early weeks, though, does indicate some other concerns, including a very dominant concern over political reform. H.R. 1, the first designated bill, is this is comprehensive. These issues are interrelated, and they are critical to anything else in our democracy. The question of gerrymandering, the question of voter suppression, the question of big money dominating politics, all those things are interrelated. So we're going to have an early expression of determination to deal with those things. And then gun violence as well. Gun violence is at the top of the agenda. That's something new, by the way, as a partisan issue. And the Democratic Party is certainly united now behind some of these common sense gun measures.
David Price here on the WNC Politics Podcast. We're going to move to questions in a few minutes, but let's stick with that for a moment. Common sense gun reform. You've got a Democratic majority in the House. You still have a Republican, of course, in the White House and Republicans leading the Senate. What common sense gun reforms are feasible?
Well, we're soon going to know. The approach, the tactic that we're taking here is designed to improve our chances. The first bill is not, I mean, most of us think, I'll speak for myself, I think there's a number of issues here that are needed, way overdue. I would include there a renewal of the assault weapon ban. These weapons of mass killing don't have any place on the streets. I'm hopeful about the gun violence protective orders, this legislation that's taken off in some states where you can get protective orders, you can get guns taken away from people who are a menace to themselves or others, and there's a way the federal government could facilitate that. So there's a long agenda, but the first item, and the simplest item, and the most, I think, bipartisan item is reforming the background check system. We already have background checks, supposedly. Only trouble is it's like a sieve. Doesn't work. It's not complete. Doesn't cover gun shows. Doesn't cover online transactions. It often doesn't work from a very good database. So fixing the background check system is H.R. 8. That's a bill that, if everything goes well, we'll be voting on next week. We're keeping that separate, because it does have bipartisan support, and it has such a basic approach to this that the hope is that if we can pass that, and we might actually get the votes we need in the Senate and send that to the President. I don't have great hopes about that, but I do think that approach makes sense, and it's precisely aimed at breaking down some of the polarization. You know, there's no reason. Campaign reform's the same way. These used to be bipartisan. Remember McCain-Feingold?
I do.
Right? That was bipartisan. The presidential public financing after Watergate was bipartisan. As our politics has gotten more polarized, as the Republican Party has gone off in a more extreme direction, that has become harder. Hopefully with H.R. 8, with this background check bill, we can begin to inch back toward a more bipartisan base of support.
There are a lot of things to follow up on. You'd mentioned gerrymandering somewhere in there. I believe, and please tell me if I'm mistaken, you yourself have reformed your own opinion on independent redistricting and gerrymandering. You were once not a proponent of that. You would now support independent redistricting. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you pretty much have that right.
Okay.
I didn't have that as at the top of my list years ago. I do think, I'll say this in the defense of the way Democrats handle this in the General Assembly. I know it's very commonplace to say, they both do it to each other, and there's some pretty egregious examples right now of Democratic gerrymandering, but it is
your district, and I not
no,
you didn't
no,
draw the district, but
no,
your
that's
district.
Republic, no,
well,
no.
Right, the Republicans drew a Democratic district that you serve, which is incredibly gerrymandered. Just
that's,
as an example, I'm not pointing a finger at you.
No, that's important correction. It was not drawn for my benefit, believe me.
Right.
The idea is to pack every Democrat in sight into the 4th district, and then make all the others Republican. There's some examples of Democratic dominated. Gerrymandering. Maryland is a case in the Supreme Court right now, but it's something mainly the Republicans have taken to new levels after the 2010 election. So I remember the earlier districting under Democratic control of the General Assembly, and sure, it had a tilt, but it was nothing like this. And so I think the issue has reached a kind of acute point now, and it's not just a question of whose ox is being gored. It's also a question of the kind of techniques and the audacity of this extraordinary political gerrymandering. I think it's reached the point where actually the Supreme Court is looking for a basis to rein this in or to create some limits. But I don't know if they're going to be able to find that. That's at stake, of course, in this North Carolina case.
That's correct. The technology is absolutely sophisticated, and I do wonder, had Democrats maintained control of the General Assembly in 2010, what level of gerrymandering we would have seen. Because there are new techniques, I think you used the word techniques, there are new techniques available today and available in 2011 and 2012 that we just didn't have in 1991 or 2001.
Yeah, it's partly the techniques. I think it's also, though, the political audacity, and I'd like to think that Democrats would not have taken it nearly this far.
So the question of independent redistricting is going to be before the U.S. Supreme Court next month. A three-judge federal panel has already ruled that congressional maps here are illegal on a partisan basis, and that's never been ruled before by a federal court. So I mean, it's a major ruling. It was a federal, it was a precedent-setting ruling that we got last year. In the spirit of independent redistricting, what would you like to see in North Carolina? Do you want to see the lawmakers pass a bill and establish a commission? Would you like to see it put into the state constitution? What would independent redistricting look like to you?
Well, there are two basic paths we could take here, either of which would be game-changing. One would be to get the kind of decision you're describing out of the Supreme Court, and you're right, North Carolina is the ideal case to bring that. What that would mean would be that whatever the method is for drawing the districts in a given state, they'd be subject to some new criteria, some new standards. What we've done in H.R. 1 is to say the legislative solution to this would be to have a federal requirement that every state have a bipartisan or nonpartisan districting process. Probably leave some flexibility there, but the kind of system you have in California, New Jersey, Arizona, Iowa, those kinds of systems where they're taken out of the legislature and are out of a partisan setting and given a commission, that sort of thing. I would love to see North Carolina do that, and I'd like to see a federal requirement that all the states do it.
I'm holding one question from the audience. I anticipate getting several more handed up to me, and or if people have questions and you want to make your way to the microphones, we're going to move to questions here in just a moment. Do you have a position on H.R. 1, and what is the likelihood of the passage in the Senate?
H.R. 1, again, is the comprehensive political reform bill, which touches on everything from a revitalization of the Voting Rights Act to a requirement that states affirmatively expand voting opportunities, things like early voting and provisional ballots and same-day registration, to a requirement of bipartisan districting, to a requirement that super PAC ads have their contributors revealed. This actually was my initiative years ago in that McCain-Feingold bill. We have Stand By Your Ad, which is this looks like a crowd that might know who that refers to. apologies to Tammy Wynette, but the idea is that you stand by your ad, you appear in your ad, you have to take responsibility for it. Okay, what's the equivalent of that with the super PAC? We need to reverse that Supreme Court decision that gives these super PACs such unrestrained. But in the meantime, you at least need to know the Citizens for All Good Things, you know, that kind of group. Who is that? And so our proposal in H.R. 1 is that you flash the top donors on the screen. That's how you stand by that ad. And that would be, and that you need some kind of disclosure for paid internet ads and for all this proliferating political
social
communication.
Media and whatnot.
So anyway, that's H.R. 1. What's the chance for passage at the Senate? Not very good, probably. We will pass it in the House. We're giving it a very expedited committee consideration right now, and we will pass it. I'm confident of that within the next few weeks, and then the question will be: is there any kind of Republican buy-in that would get us where we need to be in the Senate? Just one further comment, though. I think if we don't have that, and I don't think we will for the comprehensive bill, then the question is, what kind of cooperation might we get on pieces of this, on more modest pieces of this? You may remember in this last congressional campaign, there was a Republican congressional candidate were in our area who complained that he was losing control of his message because of a super PAC ad that was making charges against his opponent. But it turned out that He had reason to think that could bite him, too. So he was complaining about this. That, you know, Republicans will tell you, we don't like the fact that our message is overshadowed by these super PACs that come in and supposedly trying to help us or trying to hurt our opponent. Is it going to reach a point where enough Republicans say no, at least something like disclosure, something like that, we can agree on. And so I'm gonna try to push that and see what possibilities for cooperation there might be, assuming we won't get cooperation on the big comprehensive bill.
If we're on the same page, that was George Holding, who was running in the second district, a super PAC, was attacking Linda Coleman, the Democratic challenger, for not paying her taxes on time. Holding, to his credit, denounced it, partially because if she was, and this was very much a gray area, but if Coleman had been guilty of not paying her taxes on time, Holding conceded he also was guilty of not paying his taxes.
Listen, how many people in this room pay your property taxes on the first possible day, September 1? Not a single one of us do that.
I do not. I'll own that. We're going to move to questions. If you're comfortable, if you'd like to share your name and where you're here from, please do. And if you'd rather just ask a question, go right ahead.
Thank you. My name is Ashley. I'm from Durham. In the age of ads of unknown origin, with the proliferation of fake news and this powerful psychological bias we have to discount anything that we disagree with, how on earth are we going to move forward and defend ourselves from, for one, those really insidious social media influences of foreign actors, and also some more good old-fashioned fraud like what we saw in North Carolina's 9th District?
Well, it is a pretty formidable new environment that we're dealing with in many aspects that you touched on. I think with respect to foreign interference in our elections and election fraud, we need to have solid laws and enforce them. And we certainly need to have enhanced investigative capabilities to know what's going on, to be aware of it, and to stop it. And so that's pretty obviously a front for election reform. And I should have mentioned that that is a component of H.R. 1. That capacity would be improved. The social media, I think, is going to have to be, there's going to have to be some kind of regulation in the public interest about how these huge media, these social media firms operate, and on access that foreign actors, malign actors have to this. I mean, there are, of course, First Amendment values that we want to protect, but the number of fake sites, the number of manipulated communication is just astounding, and it really has the capacity to distort our politics. There are reports this week that there is a lot of malign activity already with respect to several of the Democratic presidential contenders. These companies need to clean up their act to the extent they can, and I think they can do a lot more on their own. But I do think we're dealing with a new reality here that is going to require governmental scrutiny, investigation, and then some very carefully crafted regulatory measures.
Ashley, thanks for that question. I'm going to try to do a couple here just because there are a lot of good ones on the index cards. We'll try to sneak in a couple here. Has there been any movement on the legislation to provide back pay for government contractors who lost 35 days of pay during the shutdown?
That is an area that we were not able to resolve before this conference concluded. So, no, we do not have a comprehensive solution for that. There were some things that unfortunately didn't get resolved that should have been. Violence Against Women Act renewal was another. But the contractors, we're not done with that. I think from the congressional side, we need to exercise oversight and pressure on agencies to do the right thing when it is within their capacity to do so. Otherwise, we really may need to revisit that legislatively.
Probably could have a three-hour conversation on this next question, so 30 seconds.
Sure.
What do you think North Carolina Democrats can do to ensure that North Carolina goes to the Democratic nominee in 2020? Like how I gave you just 30 seconds there, didn't I? What's the key to making that happen?
It'll help to have a good nominee. And And to because North Carolina is a mainstream state, you know. I mean, we have some nice peculiar qualities, but basically we're our Democratic Party and our Democratic process are part of a national process. So we have a stake in the way this presidential nomination process goes, and it's really going to be different for us to have this many contenders and this complicated a process. We also, of course, have a Senate race, a key Senate race. We're going to be trying to reelect our governor, and so there's going to be a premium on organization and on the kind of political mobilization that keeps us united and keeps us engaged. And so I don't know any very unique suggestion to make except the old-fashioned virtues of organization and communication. We're a swing state. We can win this state in 2020. All indications are that it will be a good year for Democrats, but not if we don't organize to take advantage of it.
Hi, Representative. My name is Nathan Spencer. I sit on the Raleigh Transit Authority as well as being a Wake County resident. With the housing economy being lackluster in the past decade and rising rents and costs in Wake County growing at 60 plus people per day, we're implementing finally a transit system that is almost 10 years too late. And we want to get it going, and I hope for your help next year on that, but one of our big factors is density and affordability. Our state ties our hands in terms of affordable housing. Is there anything that the new Democratic House can do to help us with affordable housing as well as other cities that are having the same problem?
Absolutely. Although there are local questions of zoning and land use that are not going to be dictated from the federal level and that the city and the county are going to have to deal with. And fortunately, it appears that the city of Raleigh and Wake County are determined to do that. If we just let nature take its course, just let the market forces prevail, we are going to press more and more people out into the outer suburbs, and we're going to find that people who really should be living among us, people of all diverse walks of life and income, you know, simply will not be able to afford to live close in, and that's not acceptable. It is going to require a concerted effort to make these land use decisions and to encourage these developments in a way that provide diverse housing. What does the federal government do on this? The federal government needs to be a partner in this from the appropriations perch that I'm going to be on. Both of these issues, transportation and housing, just couldn't be more critical to our region, and I'm well aware of that. Partly we just need to have robust funding available for transit new starts, for creative projects like the Tiger Grants, like that's what is building Raleigh's Union Station and going to make a multimodal center possible there. There is not a single housing account, as far as I'm concerned, that isn't under-resourced right now. Everything from public housing to Section 8 rental assistance to home programs for developing mixed-use developments. So we need to have good funding. We need to have effective administration of the funding, and that is a challenge right now. We can't just vote for more money, but we need to make sure that HUD is having the kind of process they need to have to get applications, to encourage the initiatives that then they can support. My aspiration is to realize housing as a front burner issue, as right up there with healthcare and education. I think it is just as critical and requires just as much attention. It's equally significant in terms of the well-being of our communities.
True.
One here. Will the WNC Politics podcast be hosting and recording a podcast with an invited Republican congressman or congresswoman to balance the perspectives on all the important topics raised today? Good question. Answer would be yes, if I have my druthers. Hopefully in the month or two ahead. That was one of the first things I did say to my bosses when we talked about doing this forum here. I said, are we going to continue to do these? Would love to do one, whether it's a Congressman Holding or Representative Walker. I think these forums are great. And whoever asked that question, I hope you'll come if we or when we do another one.
Congressman David Bland from Raleigh. A two-part question. Number one, do you think Barr is going to release Mueller's report? And if he does not, what role do you think the Congress will be able to play in making that public?
I don't want to speculate, or I have no basis for speculating on what Mr. Barr's approach is going to be. The immediate question is Mueller going to finish his work and be allowed to finish his work? That is absolutely essential. Mr. Barr, in his confirmation hearings, made what looked to be just airtight guarantees in that regard. You know the recent, the last 24 hours, the news reports that might indicate this is coming to a conclusion. I just don't know if there's any kind of cutting short of this. That absolutely must not occur, and Congress needs to be all over it if there's any suspicion that it is occurring. And the report needs to be made public. I hope we won't have to take drastic action to make that happen, but we may have to. And then there's also the question of what kind of evidence we ourselves have, what kind of evidence that we should draw on. Adam Schiff, for example, and the Intelligence Committee, and the follow-on or the complement to Mueller's findings, and that needs to be vigorously pursued. Hard to know exactly what the dimensions of that are, though, until we know what the timetable is for Mueller's release, and also what the scope of his findings is going to be.
Hi, my name is Andrea. I live here in Chapel Hill. It's my opinion that there's one person in Washington who has too much power. I think that person is the Senate Majority Leader by virtue of the ability to bring certain votes to the floor. And I'm thinking not just most recently of the shutdown, but also of Merrick Garland, who didn't have the benefit of an up or down vote in the Senate. It seems like the Constitution was written with checks and balances, congressional oversight over the executive branch, but the Senate Majority Leader doesn't seem to have that same check. Any thoughts on a way that we can have a better check on the control that that single person has in Washington?
Well, first of all, I agree with the premise of your question. I certainly agree with the premise of the question. And if we'd gotten a little further into the shutdown scenario, that would have come up, because you ask yourself, why did we have a five-week shutdown? First of all, the president brought this on us. This is the only shutdown that I know of that the president actually precipitated. The majority leader stayed on the sidelines, and his Republican members didn't apparently create enough pressures to bring him off the sidelines. That shutdown, of course, should never have occurred. But having occurred, it shouldn't have lasted. It should have been days, not weeks. And so you're right that it's a kind of strange view, I think, that Mitch McConnell is regarded as an institutionalist. You often hear that said about him. I mean, that is an abdication, I would say, of institutional responsibility. Remember what his line was in all this, that he said he would bring something to the floor only that the president would sign. I mean, think about that. He should have been all over the president, in my opinion, and these Republican senators should have never let this reach the dimension that it did. Oh, and by the way, speaking of institutionalist, now what he's done, he did apparently persuade the president to sign the bill. Yes, he signed the bill, so he did that. But what was the price for that? To totally abandon institutional defense with respect now to this emergency declaration, which flies in the face of the constitutional role of the Congress and the appropriations process in particular. I think we will successfully challenge that, but it's not going to be thanks to Mitch McConnell. So Is there a structural or legal solution to this? I don't think so. I mean, he's the elected majority leader of the Senate. If the Senate doesn't want to defend itself and doesn't want to assert its institutional prerogatives, then it's hard to make them do so. But I think it's pretty clear where the responsibility lies.
Would you support term limits for Congress members and senators?
No, I would not. And it's not just because they would clearly fall pretty heavily on me. No, and for what human organization would you suggest that that leadership should arbitrarily be limited in that way? Look, there are people for whom one term is too many. I could.
Let me just interject and offer the brief context yeah. of, in North Carolina, judges are required to retire when they turn 72. Mm-hmm. So that is something of a term limit that we do have in politics in our domain.
Well, that's another argument about the retirement age, that the voluntary or required retirement age. But the notion that the ability of a district to elect and re-elect its members should be arbitrarily limited is a strange argument. The practical effect would be to turn over a great deal more power to lobbyists, to bureaucrats, to staff, to whoever has staying power. I think the institution needs a mix of new blood and experience, and that's true of any human institution. Why wouldn't it be true of this one?
I think the age range in the House, and I find it fascinating, in the U.S. House right now is 29 or 30. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to, and I'm going to forget his name, the dean of the House, the representative from Alaska, who I think is 86 or 87 now.
That's probably right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you made a decision yet on 2020? Will you run again?
I have not made a decision.
Okay. Two more.
Hi, my name is Cassie, and I'm a neuroscientist and a mother, and I live here in Chapel Hill. I believe that climate change is the biggest threat facing our
yes.
country and our world, and I don't think we can wait until our president is out of office to take action. What can and will the Congress do to address this threat?
Well, I think you're right about the nature of the threat and the dire consequences of not stepping up our action. The efforts to get hold of this in a more comprehensive way during the last administration were of mixed success. As you know, the comprehensive approach to greenhouse gas emissions, the so-called cap-and-trade system, that failed in the Congress thanks to a filibuster. President Obama was able to support the Paris Accords and to get us engaged in the international effort in a positive way. That now has been withdrawn by President Trump, and of course he mocks the science of climate change. There are incremental things that are still going on. Partly the marketplace is increasingly receptive to renewable energy, and some of these technologies are doing very well. And on their own, there's a switch going on from the old coal-fired plants and so on. But it isn't enough, and there needs to be a comprehensive approach taken, and we are determined in the new majority to do that. There is this Green New Deal proposal, which I think is a way of expressing urgency here and urging a kind of coordinated effort. I think that's a good thing. I think the more direct legislative efforts with some very seasoned and capable chairs of the committees, I look for those to move forward. And on all fronts, conservation, the development of renewables, research, battery storage, the kind of technologies that are needed to make this more these cleaner energy sources more widespread, more efficient. It does need to be a major effort going forward.
yes or no, would you support the Green New Deal in its current iteration?
It's simply an aspirational statement, and yes, I signed on.
Last one.
Thank you for coming this morning, Representative Price. My name is Mark Roden. I'm from Durham. My question is, President Trump in his State of the Union address mentioned socialists, and this seems to be the main theme of his reelection campaign. What is the Democratic Party going to do, in your opinion, to make it easier for Democratic candidates to be elected in 2020 so that the campaign theme of socialism that President Trump seems to be employing will be mitigated?
In terms of being accused of socialism, I mean, what else is new? You know, that's, I've certainly dealt with that all my political life. I've studied enough history to know that socialism is a pretty fluid concept, but I think it's probably best not to throw labels around and to simply talk about the kind of policies and approaches to government that we favor. Is Medicare socialist? I think actually a lot of the people throwing these labels around do think that Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid are socialist. They certainly said that at the time that they were being enacted during the New Deal and afterwards in the Great Society. So yesterday's socialism becomes today's sacred cow. So I think we're better off just seeing that as the kind of agitation that it is, especially coming from the president, and to tend to our business here in terms of the things we need to do to improve this country and not worry about the labels we place on it.
He serves North Carolina's 4th Congressional District. He is a 16-term member of the United States House of Representatives. Congressman David Price, thank you for joining the Politics
Thank
podcast
you. It's great
again.
To be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Big thanks to our live studio audience at the Friday Center here in Chapel Hill as well. You can gather the WNC Politics podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. This program was produced by David Brower and Elizabeth Friend. Brent Wolf is our news director. Our engineer today was Graham Youngblood, and it was recorded here at the Friday Center, again in front of that live studio audience. For Congressman David Price, I'm Jeff Tabiri. Thank you for listening.